This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, welcome to Night School, the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the humanities and the social sciences, together with Sharat Kutan. I, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, will be going over every week some key ideas and thoughts to help you better understand the world around you. Today, we're actually going to talk about Martin Heidegger's famous book, Being in Time. Have a conversation to simplify some of the key themes in that book.
Yeah, I mean, Heidegger is very famous. I mean, he's like one of those big, you know, European philosophers when you think of them. Because I know I studied this in university. He's extremely dense. It's not the easiest thing.
No, he's not.
Getting your head around things like Dasein.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how to begin to explain what that means. So much for my education.
But one good starting point will be his concept of authenticity. And I think this is a good way into the broader dense stuff, because I think it's probably the concept that everybody can relate to the most.
Could we start with a kind of background on the man? Mm-hmm. I mean, which century he comes from, mm-hmm. and his influence and such?
Sure. He was born in the late 19th century, I think 1890 it was. Same year Adolf Hitler was born.
And 2 years after Karl Marx died.
which really, I think, foretold the state of things to come at that time in Europe. And started out a deeply religious person. He had a spiritual crisis, which I think coloured his philosophical turns eventually. But he's most well known for this book, Being in Time, which catapulted him into fame in European academia. And that took him out of the shadows of his mentor, Edmund Husserl, a very famous phenomenologist and mathematician who Heidegger served as pretty much an assistant for a while. Heidegger is most well known, I think, to non-philosophers, being a Nazi.
Well, that's disputed, right? I mean, there was that famous speech he gave, and you know,
there were a few famous speeches he gave,
and you know, when he was made a rector of a university or something like that, right? And I mean, okay, so that's a controversy that's worth kind of doing an entire episode on, because it's much theorized, and the question of whether you can pin Nazism on him or make a direct link between these things.
Well, what is disputable is a direct link between his philosophy and Nazism. But he was a member for a long time, and during the denazification period after the war, he never repented or repudiated. In fact, Karl Jaspers, during the denazification period, and Karl Jaspers was also a well-known philosopher at the time, he said Heidegger should be allowed to write, but he should not be allowed to teach, because he was so influential and because he's been very forthright during the heyday of Nazism about his affiliation with the party. There's a lot of theory about where the philosophy is linked, and I think that's a separate discussion. But his commitment to the movement and even Adolf Hitler was quite overt. And, you know, I think it's a good basis to have broader conversations too about whether or not intellectuals should be read in light of their politics.
Yeah, their commitments, their social commitments, their personal biographies. Yeah, I mean, we often want the biographical to kind of locate the individual, mm-hmm. but is that sufficient to, in this case, taint mm-hmm. their philosophies, right? So it works in one way, in that sometimes you see their philosophy as the expression of the, you know, the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, mm-hmm, or political events, you know, crisis and such. But then when it comes a bit kind of tricky when you want to accuse somebody, say, of being a racist or mm-hmm. being, you know, in this case, a Nazi. So that's when we try to problematize it perhaps a little too much.
And interestingly, Hannah Arendt, who was Heidegger's mistress and student for a while, really boiled it down to the fact that Heidegger was what she called an idiotes. You know, there's a Greek for, I guess, well,
not idiot, obviously.
Well, it's come to us as the word idiot that we know, but in Greek, it really refers to an unworldly person, a private person who's really incompetent about worldly things. So for Hannah Arendt, Heidegger's misadventures with the Nazism project was really due to the fact that he did not know much outside of academic philosophy. And this was an indictment Hannah Arendt made about philosophy and philosophers in general.
Also, that he lived the life of the mind to such extent that he was slightly naive in mm-hmm. his relationship with the Nazi Party. Is mm-hmm. that it?
And not to say that he did not know he wasn't sort of unaware of what was going on, but that the broader implications in the world of politics. It's not something a philosopher would necessarily be prescient about.
Well, so, you know, that's curious because in some ways, I mean, this whole show is about taking quite a different tack. I mean, the idea is that to understand philosophy, and particular philosophies, to be more conscious of a certain clarity and mm-hmm. discipline in talking about the world, mm-hmm. that we do, in fact, become better citizens, individuals, human beings, yes. brothers, sisters, whatever it is, yes. right? I mean, that's really, I think, our intention in doing the show.
Yes. And just a little sidetrack to Arendt, for her, this connection was lost for a long time, especially in the modern period. You know, this was this continuation between philosophy and the real world was something the Greeks had more than the moderns. And this bifurcation can be seen in the case of Heidegger and what he eventually, when it came to his politics. So all this to say that he's a very controversial figure. And as a result, this has, as you said, also translated to the politics of reading Heidegger. So like Derrida, who was very drawn to Heidegger, very influenced by Heidegger, who believes that there are, for lack of a better word, radical potentials in a supposedly, you know, fascist-leaning inspired text. And of course, there are people who are on the left, thinkers on the left, who feel that Heidegger's project is really too brushed with that.
What you mean by that is that you can take a politically dubious project and maybe harness or deploy its intellectual, you know, gems or whatever's worthy of it in terms of how it thinks about the world for a very different type of politics.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
That would be closer to what Derrida have tried to do with Heidegger.
Right. So in some sense, there is a distinction between the philosophy and some of the implications of that philosophy.
Correct. Okay. So the more specific distinction that Derrida is trying to make would be along those lines, philosophy and the implications. So something like Adorno did not do that, you know. And what he did was try to draw the problems in the philosophy and the implications as well, that it cannot be so neatly divorced. For our purposes, though, I think we could start with trying to get a grasp at what Heidegger was trying to do. And his main concern, put in simple terms, was the alienation of man in modern world. He felt that technology, the rise of consumer culture, had really, in drastic and deeply disturbing ways, taken us away from ourselves, where the default orientation is conformity, the default impulse is to renounce our individuality. This was not just a so-called social phenomena, but it also impacted the sciences, it affected art, it impacted what we think of the future. And being in time is in a lot of ways an intervention into that mood of the modern world where we feel divorced as individuals from the rest of the world.
That's fascinating because that would have, you know, so say he comes to adulthood, right? He's 21 or so. We're looking at the early part of the 20th century when, I mean, consumerism as we know it is not as full-blown and you know, kind of wall-to-wall. I guess he would have been experiencing the transition, which is probably an interesting thing. You see the old, you see the new, and you're kind of in between, right? Mm-hmm. And he would have, of course, been caught up in the cataclysmic events of that time, mm-hmm. World War One and such. So, mm-hmm. Because in many ways, you know, his concerns are really something that we can see as being, but we live in a very different world when, in fact, consumerism is wall-to-wall.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And conformity is the default mode, right?
Correct. But the interesting thing is that this has been concern well since the 19th century, people like Kierkegaard, who saw mass culture. Of course, consumerism was milder compared to today, but I think it's a testament to the kind of thinkers they were. I mean, they're brilliant that they could sense where this was going. So with the fall of the old institutions and ways of doing things, you had the rise of a mass, and they were dictating culture. And this came at a high price, and Heidegger was theorizing in response to that. And I think that's one of the reasons why Being in Time continues to be read today, because it addressed this impulse. I'm sure all of us can relate to the disconcerting sense that comes when we think about just how pervasive conformity and mass culture is, because I think, and this is what Heidegger wants to point to, there is something in us that identifies ourselves differently then, you know, the way culture has taken off.
I wonder if that would be challenged by people who say that, in fact, you know, if you're likely to read Heidegger, you're going to be in the real minority, you know, kind of like manufacturing for yourself a discontent that, in fact, is not shared. I mean, that people today actually are quite happy. They've taken for granted this world. It's, you know, and the assumptions about how you live and how you identify yourself through consumer goods. I mean, you are defined by the type of phone you choose to purchase and such, right? So,
and there's a term for that type of sense of the world. And Heidegger calls it Das Man. And Das Man, he would say, is in the state of falling. And basically, it's pretty ontological. All this to say that exactly what you described, this sort of being at home with not being at home.
Or being at home with the inauthentic.
Inauthentic, correct. So there's something about, you know, when you identify yourself as not necessarily you, but the they. And this robs you of the greater authentic expressions of you that you can be resolute about.
But in all of these kind of debates, and we see them, you know, coming up in many of our discussions, who is the philosopher to tell us that we're not happy, that we're living inauthentic lives, that what we ought to feel is this, and because we don't feel it, we're somehow fallen or in false consciousness or deluded, you know?
Yes, and there are arguments and steps and signposts that Heidegger shares for this. Now, just to be clear, though, Heidegger does not subscribe to a simple binary between the individual and the mass. He believes that's faulty as well. In fact, that is an exemplification of alienation too when we think in those terms. Because what he does not want is a detached view of the world. He does not believe that, you know, when we confront the anxieties of mass culture, what we should do is divorce ourselves from it as if a separate entity. Because that detachment speaks to the broader tendency that human beings have to think in terms of detachment. When we talk about objectivity, when we talk about knowledge, we talk about science, there's always this idea that it's transcendent, it's somewhere else. And that to him is just another instance of alienation. So he does not believe that this our divorcing of ourselves from the world is any better. In fact, it's just a reflection of what's there, you know, which is alienating modern life. So that's the problem. I think we've kind of identified the problem pretty well. I hope our listeners too can sort of see where they stand in this problem, and you know, something that I think, you know, makes this question very human. So to begin with, what are we if we're not Das Man? And Das Man is really, the man here really refers to one, kind of the dispassionate one, in a way, in the same way that we would say in English, one should not smoke in public or something like that, you know, a kind of impersonal one, right? And that's what he's trying to convey. So, and this is where, in understanding what the human person is, and Heidegger doesn't use the word the human person or the subject, because it would reflect that detached notion. So, he uses the word Dasein, and Dasein is something that is a cornerstone of his philosophy. And to unpack that, we should, I think, wait for the second part where we can kind of give it more precise attention and move on from there. So this is Night School. You're listening to me, Ahmad Farama, and Sharat Kutan. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. This is Ahmad Fuad Rahman alongside me, Sharat Kutan, and we are talking about Heidegger. And first part of the show, we talked about his problem with the modern world, and now we're trying to get back to where we left off, which was to talk about his conception of us, which is Dasein.
Yeah, we also talked about the modern world's problems with him and his tarrying with the Nazi party. But okay, yes. we'll leave that for now.
You're right. And I think it just shows just how alienated he was to want to throw his lot there. And he offers a view of human existence that he feels is closer to reality in a way. And this he names Dasein. Dasein really just means exist. But Heidegger likes to play with words, and if what he tries to point out in this word is the combination of the word there and being there. And what he wants to show is that when you really grasp us Dasein as being there, as being in the world, what we see is a picture of engaged lives, that we are not detached, that we are not removed from the world around us, and that fundamentally, if we think of ourselves as engaged creatures in our world, we do not see ourselves as detached or dispirited or really dispassionate in as we go on in our lives. He wants to really point to this embeddedness in the world that really shapes us.
You know, one of the things that a sociologist might do or a social commentator is to look at specific practices, right? So you come from a world where there's a very strong or dominant artisan culture. People are making things, but they're making things in a small scale. They are there from the start to the finish of the making of a product, you know. And then you move to the assembly line and how, you know, the individual worker is working on just one specific part, and he could spend his whole life just making a widget or a bolt in a larger piece, and he need not actually understand the full product. So that's the stuff that, say, a sociologist or a social commentator or a cultural critic might look at potentially when they look out in the world. What does the philosopher do? I mean, was he, you know, referencing these concerns to actual things he saw in the world, or was it in the language that he was starting? Because you so far talked about definitions and wordplay and such. I mean, is that where the philosopher is kind of working things out?
Yes and no. Now, this goes back to the fundamental question of being in time. And for Heidegger, what he was interested in is being, not beings. He's not interested in separate entities. He's interested in being itself, for, you know, in crude terms, reality itself, or more particularly, the grounding out of which things appear for and to us, which is the basis of knowledge. So he has a bit of a different concern, and you can tell it's a bit odd, you know, when you pose this to sociologists, they cringe a bit sometimes, you know, from at least from my experience. But what you describe in, say, something like the typical of social sciences is this very detached assumption that I am not of this world. I'm going to come and examine and kind of unpack, draw connections, separate concepts, distinguish them in my phenomena and kind of compile it in my study and give an empirical account of things. And while this might produce a discourse that's very sociological, Heidegger believes that this is particularly the kind of detachment in our attitude to knowledge that really just compounds the alienation. What he wants to go for is understanding human beings as feeling, as invested, as connected and embedded in the world. And not necessarily phenomena. Phenomena assumes a sort of distinction again, but he wants to point to the worldliness.
So what does he do? Is it a series of statements he makes?
Correct.
He makes. So,
statements, but he's also naming experience. He wants to show that fundamentally Dasein is bound by the similar experience that makes all sort of questioning and knowledge seeking possible. That ultimately, no matter what our profession is, what line of thought is, we approach our inquiries in an engaged orientation. So in a very basic sense, when you tell me, like, I walk into the office and I go, hey, shut up, what's going on? It's like, and you say, oh, you know, I'm just tired, had a long week, right? The kind of detached mode would be, oh, Sharad is tired, he had a long week, right? But for Heidegger, what he wants us to realize is that this is a Dasein who has been thrown himself into the world to such an extent that you have been compelled to engage with the moods that's taken over a storm inside you that's made you call it tired. There's this engaged life that's tired. And I have not been able to see it because I'm so used to orienting myself in alienated ways that I just think you're just a guy who uttered the statement that you're tired. Whereas you are this Dasein who's thrown into the world, who has become tired by virtue of your embeddedness in the world. See, that is what he's trying to go for.
Oh, okay. Know? But so, okay, so his starting point is the conceptual. He's actually saying Da Correct. And Sein and Da Sein and what does this mean and how. And so he's working it out at a... At
conceptual,
seems,
correct.
Yeah, it seems to me highly abstract way. I mean, he's not working from the details of the raw material, the world,
he's not.
Social world or whatever, the economic world. Okay.
So he's not sampling anything. He's not fielding anything. He's naming human experience. He's describing human experience and he is pointing to something that he believes is common to Dasein, which is being engaged in the world. There are two things that come out of this. The first is that, so when you really take a look at everybody, I mean, again, the dayness, when you say how we've fallen, right? Everybody's just sort of moving like cogs in a machine. But if you really understand each of us as being a part of the world and as a consequent invested, embedded, and engaged, what you see and feel is sorga, this sense that we are all caring. And we all care because we are somehow anxious. You know, that the world affects us and we are affected by the world and this influences us. And this will go a long way in shaping our questions, in shaping our attitude to knowledge. And when we really grasp that, we grasp that the human person and the world are interchangeable. That there is no distinction between what is a human being and what is the world. Where does the human beings play? What is my play? What is the soul? All these things are questions that are enabled by a kind of detachment from the world. But for Heidegger, he wants to show that we are being in the world.
Now, you know, it's...
We're Dasein.
We are Dasein. We are Dasein to come out on every week, it seems, to talk about philosophy or social theory. Now, I want to ask you, it seems... Okay, the way you put it, it's very clear. But it sounds like a series of assertions.
Yes.
You know, and if I remember correctly, this was not a thin book.
No.
You know, it wasn't these epigrammatic kind of... You know, chestnuts of wisdom about caring or whatever. It seems that what is it that he had to kind of work against in order to make these assertions?
Okay. So he is introducing a new brand of phenomenology. Now we have to go back to a bit sidetracking on this discourse called phenomenology. And it was popularized and institutionalized in academia at the time. Largely under the design and leadership of Edmund Husserl, who wanted to search a foundation for knowledge. And Husserl saw this foundation in the transcendental ego, basically the conscious subject. And it's very much like Descartes, who we've talked about, I think, last year, that wanted to understand what is the basis on which we can be certain of knowledge. And he locates this in the human who knows the world. And what Heidegger wants to do is to show that human knowing is a Dasein that is embedded in the world rather than a kind of detached frame. And this was something that he had to go against considerably, largely because of how influential and pervasive the egoistic mode of knowing, the egoistic mode of consciousness.
And what is the distinction? Why is not the ego also the Dasein?
Because Dasein is the world. Dasein is a worldly knowing.
Like, okay, so that's when you say that distinction between the individual and the world is something that
Husserl, correct.
That Husserl had, but Heidegger rejects.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So, and Heidegger is going to introduce the notion of time, which we'll get to pretty soon, into the equation as well. So because once we see ourselves as embedded, and once we see our Dasmanness or our fallen state as really a farce or something that we really fly into when we cannot handle our anxieties, then the question then becomes, all right, what is the alternative? And Heidegger is really going to accentuate the role of time. And when we look at time in a worldly sense, it's not just time in the abstract sense, but time as history, time as culture, and so forth. And this is where he's going to take us. So back to Dasein's worldliness and how we've fallen into Deiness. Question here then is in our individuality, our authenticity. So we know that we are embedded, but this is too much for us, so we fall back into the Deiness. So what does authenticity mean? So we mentioned earlier that it's not individuality. It's not this sort of affirmation of, again, detached individuality from a detached sense of community. So what he's going to point to is something greater than that. And for this, I think a good way into what authenticity would be is to another concept, which is another mouthful. It's being towards death. I think you've heard of this. I mean, people who roughly have browsed through Heidegger's work would have seen this somehow.
I might have skipped this class because I had tremendous problems getting up early in the morning to go to class. But
it's very central here. And it's been inflated unnecessarily. Some people think of this as a kind of fascination with death that Heidegger has. In a more basic sense, Heidegger wants us to think about the possibility that one day there will be nothing, and that this is something that we'll have to meet. And basically, it's a simple point to say that it is when we really grasp the fact that we will one day be nothing, that we are really individuated, that we really realize ourselves as who we are. You know, there's this sort of famous popular conception of our encounter with death where our whole lives, you know,
flash before us,
childhood, adolescent traumas, adulthood, you know,
rites of passage, weddings, all that
leading to that moment. And it's not exactly what, obviously Heidegger didn't describe that in the book, but I think it's an interesting impulse in there, because it just shows that when we do really grasp that moment, we really sense how personal and how unique and how individuated we are in the world. And this is something that we miss because we have fallen into Dasein, the pre-ontological stage, or because sometimes the angst is too much for us. But if we really put that into our frame of living, we just really realize the uniqueness of the path we take every day.
I mean, you say pre-ontological, and I think it's something that probably needs to be unpacked a little bit, because what is it to talk about individuals to be as pre-ontological? I mean, they clearly exist in the world, yes. Right? So yes. they are, ontologically speaking, there, right? But you're saying, so obviously, you had a means. What does Heidegger mean by pre-ontological?
To be ontological is for Heidegger to ask questions. And we are beings that the question of being matters. That's what Dasein is.
I mean, basically, you don't actually, you're not deserving of the status of being until you are a questioning being.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
But, this is where the start draws from him too here, is when we ask a question, we're pointing out what's not there. What's not there, basically. And for Heidegger, this is a remarkable capability for human beings to notice what's not there and to really ask. And this relates to the notion of Dasein. This is for him, the Dasein definition is the being for whom the question of being matters, and that's us. And
I like that. The being for whom the question of being matters.
Correct.
Okay.
And we have questions because we're embedded. And we're embedded in such a way that we know there is something there. And how do we know we have something? It's because we have questions. So the they is the pre-ontological, because, you know, the they, the masses, they don't really, they ask questions, but they don't know what it means to ask questions, you know. But if you are individuated, at the moment in which you confront death, your questions resonate differently. They give a strange echo in you, right?
As you're talking about this, and we have put in a bracket his politics, but his politics and his party was a party of the mass. I mean, it wanted to create a mass society. Of course, it had the Führer, but below was this mass, and in some ways, an unthinking mass was what was demanded by Nazi Germany. It's curious that he should have been so enamored of their politics, if this was his kind of assertions about what it is to be fully human.
his response, well, there were a couple. The first was that it was not as great as it could have been.
You mean the Nazi period? The Third Reich?
The Nazi movement.
Yeah, because it kind of ended rather abruptly. Okay.
And I think, and he did, okay, so what I know is that he said that the Nazi party could not have been, did not end up being as great as it could have been. Now, that one is quite clear, he said it. The other thing he said, the other thing that other people attribute him to saying was that it too, from its good origins, deviated into a movement of mass technology, mass culture. So something Heidegger saw. But then the question becomes, why didn't he renounce it? Why did he stay as a member throughout the party? You know,
it would have been difficult at that point actually to leave. You know, can you imagine dissenting voice and
that's
doing?
But people did though. People did dissent.
Wow, he didn't.
He didn't. He was a career. I mean, one thing is quite clear too, and this is, I guess, I'm taking some liberties here. And it seems to me that the consensus among historians is that he wasn't a particularly nice person. He was quite an egomaniac too. And again, I'm taking liberties here. You might have different account of, you know, you've read different account of him biographically. But from what I've read, it seems that's to be the case. Yeah.
Okay, so we have deviated a little bit from the... Have we finished in terms of the kind of basic outline of what Heidegger wanted to do with his discussion of Dasein? Are we complete?
No, well, we're almost there. So once we individuate ourselves by a true grasping of our individuality, when we confront death, what Heidegger calls for is for us to be resolute. Now, for authenticity is really how another word for it is being one's own. But it's not a tranquil sense of home. Heidegger calls us to rise, to become extraordinary, to see that our mundane lives in the day has really robbed us of our ownness. And what he calls for is to be resolute, not to be like separate individuals, right? Like in our homes or something like that, but to really, and this is where it's important, the solution is to throw ourselves, to really commit ourselves to our history. And this is where historicity matters. But history for Heidegger is not to be understood in a very abstract sense of time, abstract, you know, ideas of what happened or something, but our particular moment in the world as it is now. And in a concrete sense, if we are not detached, what we see is the centrality of culture. And for him to be authentic is to be resolute as a subject of history. And what this means is to be resolute in a culture.
Okay, very nice. So you talked us through. I wish I had attended those classes. I have the image of my professor, you know, and maybe me slightly bleary-eyed looking at him and thinking, well, I should have done the readings before
I came
to class.
This is for 30-minute consumption, like, by no means exhaustive, by no means exhaustive. And I think I've been fast and loose on a few things. But for the most part, it should. I would hope that your interest is piqued.
Okay, so what do we read?
Being in Time. It's
that's the only way, the heavy lifting.
But there is a documentary on YouTube called Being in Time by Hubert Dreyfus, which is, you can just watch. And I think that's a good introduction to Heidegger. Well, he's not easy. And in a lot of ways, he's not my favorite in many ways, because, you know, I think the way it is in philosophy, academic philosophy, is that, okay, you want to be a phenomenological existentialist. You know, if you're a leftist, you go with Sartre. Who really took Heidegger's concepts towards the left, you know, so that's one option. But I think if you're interested in intellectual history, this was a watershed moment. So it's worth checking out.
Okay, so we can continue this conversation, yep. I guess,
on our Facebook page, BFM Night School, or you can email us, bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Always interested to hear from you and your thoughts.
Yeah, and you can always tweet me, yep. Sharad Kutin. Like, somebody just recently tweeted out a link to one of our episodes from November and then started engaging me on Twitter.
What was that? Which episode was that?
It was about the West and the East. I think it was the Said one colonialism and anthropology.
Cool. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside me, Sharad Kutin. As always, you are listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.